2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 1 to 29, the 14th talk in a series on the book of 2 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on September 15, 2014, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're going to continue in our study in 2 Corinthians. The last four chapters of 2 Corinthians are kind of wild. I have entitled them, Paul Goes to War. In these chapters, Paul takes on his opponents in Corinth, and in doing so, he's really fighting for the soul of the Corinthian church. Last week, we looked at chapter 10. Some of Paul's opponents seem to be outsiders who have come to Corinth to challenge Paul for the leadership over the church. That really becomes clear in these last four chapters in a way that isn't so clear in the 1 Corinthians or in the first part of 2 Corinthians. They say that Paul is something of a fraud, a paper tiger. He writes strong letters, but in person he is meek and unimpressive. And in particular, they have contempt for the unimpressive way that Paul speaks. And they're urging the Corinthian church as a whole to listen to them, not Paul. Paul responds to them with fighting words. That is, he speaks to the church at large, telling them how they should think about Paul's opponents. As I summed it up last week, Paul says, "Yes, I know that my opponents say that I am meek and unimpressive in person, but I would warn you not to join them, because next time I come to visit you, the gloves will be off. My weapons are the divine empowerment that God has given my ministry. I will fight their errors with truth. I will call people to change their thinking in line with that truth, and I will deal harshly with those who oppose the truth." Paul is quite willing to boast in what is truly significant about himself, his authority as an apostle of Jesus Christ, but he does not want to boast as his opponents do. He will not compare himself to them as to who is a better speaker, who is more successful, etc. He will not, as they have done, step into another man's work and take credit for it himself. No, Paul will boast using the appropriate measure, the calling of God. God has given Paul the assignment of being an apostle sent to the Corinthians, and so Paul will boast in what God is doing through Paul. Let me remind you of the last words of chapter 10. "But he who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. For not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends." This is important because in chapter 11, in a sense, Paul is going to violate his own words. The very thing that he just said that he doesn't do and he doesn't want people to do, he's going to do. So let's see where he goes with this. Here's what he says in 11:1. "I wish that you would bear with me in a little foolishness, but indeed you are bearing with me." Now, Paul doesn't actually say what this foolishness is that he's about to commit. He doesn't actually spell it out until much later in the chapter. But let me tell you now, Paul's foolishness that he's asking them to bear with is that he is going to boast in the same way that his opponents do. He is going to boast in the way that he just said that he doesn't want to boast. So we'll look at that in a few minutes. But that's the foolishness that he's about to indulge himself in. I don't quite know what to do with the phrase, "but indeed you are bearing with me." It sounds, when you first read it, as if Paul is being quite gentle with them. "I wish that you would bear with me in a little foolishness, but hey, I know that you are. You know, things are good between us." The problem is that Paul is about to say some very harsh and cutting things. So I don't think it makes sense to take this as a sort of a, you know, I'm sure that you won't have any problem. I think he's being sarcastic. And there are other ways to translate it. I won't go into all the different possibilities here. It may relate to some things that we're going to see him saying later on, where he's going to talk about, very sarcastically, how willing they are to bear with things. So it's probably related to something like that, but I'm not quite sure at this point. But whatever he means, as we look at the tone of what he's about to go on to say, I don't think it's possible that he means it as a compliment. What is clear is this. Paul is about to indulge himself in what he calls foolishness, and he is saying that I hope that you will bear with me in that. But before he goes on to explicitly do this foolish thing that he's talking about, he talks about what has driven him to do it. Why is he about to do this foolish thing? And that's what we find in verses 2 through 21. And in these verses, seems to me, we see a very striking picture of the tensions in Paul's relationship with the Corinthians. Things that have been sort of hinted at various places are becoming very clear here. In verses 2 through 21, Paul describes how worried he is about the situation in Corinth. He starts out by saying, "For I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy, for I betrothed you to one husband, that to Christ I might present you as a pure virgin." So jealousy, in a way, is kind of the theme of this entire section. We have basically the classic love triangle here. Paul was hoping that the Corinthians had given their hearts to him, or rather to Christ through him, but now the Corinthians are listening to other voices, to these opponents of Paul. Will they remain faithful, or will they give their hearts to another? So that's the classic triangle we've got going here. But notice that Paul crafts his analogy carefully. Paul is not the jealous bridegroom, concerned that he is losing his beloved's affection. Christ is the bridegroom. Paul is on the sidelines. Maybe he is picturing himself as the friend of the bridegroom. Maybe he is the father of the bride in this analogy. Whoever he is not the one who is going to get married in the end. Paul has arranged a betrothal in this analogy between Christ and the Corinthians. The Corinthians are the betrothed wife. Christ is the bridegroom. So the three parties of this love triangle are Christ, the bridegroom, through Paul, his representative, then the betrothed bride, the Corinthians, and the evil seducer, the opponents of Paul and his gospel. Paul is the one who arranged this marriage, and he is concerned to keep the bride a virgin until the wedding day. That is, that she be faithful to the one that she is betrothed to. So, stepping outside the analogy, Paul is the one who taught the Corinthians about Christ. He's the one who urged them to believe in Christ, to join themselves to Christ in faith. And Paul is watching over them, hoping that they remain faithful. He is a guardian over them until that time when Christ returns. He's afraid that they're going to end up being unfaithful to Christ, that they are going to follow some other teachers who teach some other gospel. So this is Paul's godly jealousy. Are you Corinthians going to continue to listen to me, to follow the Christ that I preach? Or are you going to listen to these opponents of mine who are dismissing me and urging you to believe something else? He goes on to say, "But I am afraid, lest as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your minds should be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ." So clearly Paul sees a lot at stake here. These opponents of Paul are not just encouraging the Corinthians to dislike Paul personally. It's not just these guys are coming along and calling me names and saying they shouldn't hang around with me as much or something like that. Paul is concerned that they are leading the Corinthians astray. And he's using pretty strong language. Paul's opponents are like the serpent in the garden, seducing Eve away from listening to God. They are attempting to seduce the Corinthians away from their simple and straightforward devotion to Christ. And Paul is afraid, he says, that they might succeed. And unfortunately, Paul feels justified in his fear because of what he has seen the Corinthians do in the past. He doesn't have a great confidence in how they're going to respond to this. And he goes on to say that in 4. For if one comes and preaches another Jesus whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully. Okay, so once again, Paul is using sarcasm here. We're going to see a lot of sarcasm in this section. In essence, he's saying, look, you guys, one would think that if someone came preaching a different Jesus than the one I preached to you, that you would tell him to get lost. You would think that if someone was urging you to receive a different spirit than what you have received through my ministry, you'd think you'd tell him to get lost, to run away. If someone told you good news that was different than the gospel that you have accepted from me, one would think that you would say, no thanks, I'm going to stick with Paul's gospel. But no, when someone comes and urges you to abandon what I, Paul, taught you, you are so patient and tolerant with them. You bear with them beautifully, which is not a compliment on Paul's part. It's, why are you still listening to them? Why are those guys still around, as he's basically asking. No wonder that Paul is afraid that they're going to stop listening to him and be seduced by his opponents. He's asking himself, why are they listening to these guys? Why is this still a problem? Because Paul truly believes that he himself, as an apostle, is worthy to be listened to. This is a familiar theme. He's been saying this throughout the whole letter. But here he gets very, very explicit in verse 5. For I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles. But even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way, we have made this evident to you in all things. Okay, so I think this is a very important statement of how Paul thinks about himself, how he would ask us to think about him. But before we can understand it fully, there are two things we need to talk about, I think. First of all, what does Paul mean by the most eminent apostles? Many, and I think most, it may be true, students of 2 Corinthians think Paul is talking about his opponents. He is speaking sarcastically from their perspective. He is saying, I am not in the least inferior to these so-called super apostles, is kind of the way that they're taking that. That is possible. A few sentences later, he is going to refer to them as false apostles. So maybe that's who he has in mind here. Maybe he is sarcastically referring to his opponents as super apostles and saying, I'm not inferior to them. But I'm not convinced that that's the case. It doesn't sound quite right to me. It seems a strange way to deal with them to say that I'm not inferior to them. That doesn't sit quite right to me because he is, in fact, vastly superior to them. He's comparing them to the serpent in the garden, and you know they're going to be servants of Satan here in a few lines. So it seems like Paul would say something more than, I'm not inferior to them. It seems to make more sense to me to see Paul addressing the criticism of his opponents, which is that Paul is not impressive enough to be a true apostle. And so I see Paul as saying, pick whichever apostle you want, even the most eminent of them, like Peter or John or someone like that. I do not consider myself inferior to any of them. No matter what my opponents may be saying, I do not consider myself inferior to even the most eminent of the apostles in terms of my authority and right to be called an apostle and so forth. That's what makes more sense to me. Paul's statement then becomes a very strong one. I am not inferior to even the original eminent apostles like Peter and John. The second question we need to answer concerns this word unskilled, which might not sound like we need to answer a question there, but there is kind of a question. This is the way Paul's opponents assess him. He is unskilled in speech is the way New American Standard translates it, but there may be something more involved in that word. The Greek word usually has the sense of something like a layman, an amateur, someone who is untrained in something. Yes, the person lacks skill, but it is because he doesn't have the professional training that the skilled person has. And indeed, that may be the flavor of the word in this context. The skilled, impressive speakers were the ones who were trained in rhetoric. They made their living by publicly demonstrating their skills at debating and arguing. And of course, the trained speaker would present himself as one whose verbal skills demonstrated his wisdom and knowledge. As is often the case, the person who can speak well is often listened to as if he had actual wisdom to impart. So it's possible that Paul's opponents are suggesting that he hasn't demonstrated himself worthy to be listened to because he doesn't have that trained, polished speaking approach that the professional teacher would have, the one who comes in and demonstrates that he is significant enough to be listened to. He doesn't speak with the flamboyant, cutting skill that would show him to be a wise person. So Paul's doing something like this, I think. He's defending himself against the criticisms of his opponents. They question whether Paul is really an apostle, and they think that Paul is a contemptible, unimpressive amateur as a speaker. So Paul bluntly contradicts them. "Let me tell you how I understand my place in the world," he says. "I am as much an inspired, authoritative apostle as Peter or John. And yes, I know that I am criticized for not being a skilled, impressive speaker. Suppose I grant you that. Suppose I grant you I don't have the skills of a trained orator. So what? Even if I lack something as a speaker, I do not lack in knowledge." Just because a person has the professional polish of the trained speaker, that doesn't mean he has the actual wisdom to impart. But I do have that wisdom. I do have that knowledge. Like the other apostles, I have been entrusted by God with a profound knowledge of the gospel. Paul is afraid that the Corinthians are going to be misled and seduced by Paul's opponents. So Paul is trying to address all the possible criticisms that his opponents have leveled at him. Paul's saying to the Corinthians, "I don't get it. Are you listening to my opponents when they say I am not an apostle? They're wrong. I am one. Are you listening to their criticism of my speaking ability? What does that matter? Isn't it more important that I know what I am talking about? And I do know what I am talking about because I am an apostle sent with a message from God. I shouldn't have to say this to you, Corinthians. You know this. I have demonstrated the depths of my understanding of the gospel to you over and over. Everything I have said and done should show you that my critics are absolutely wrong." Okay, now in verse 7, Paul turns to another criticism that his opponents have leveled at him. And this one's a little bit harder to understand what's at stake here. But starting in verse 7, he says, "Or did I commit a sin in humbling myself that you might be exalted because I preached the gospel of God to you without charge? I robbed other churches, taking wages from them to serve you. And when I was present with you and was in need, I was not a burden to anyone. For when the brethren came from Macedonia, they fully supplied my need. And in everything I kept myself from being a burden to you and will continue to do so. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine will not be stopped in the regions of Achaia. Why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. But what I am doing, I will continue to do, that I may cut off opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the matter about which they are boasting." Okay, so let's see if we can sort this out here. The situation, what we know of the situation, is something like this, as we read in various places in Acts and in 1 Corinthians. When Paul first came to Corinth, he came by himself and supported himself by doing tent making, leather work. He was a laborer. He knew this craft, and so that's how he supported himself when he didn't have any other support. But when Silas and Timothy came to join him, Paul stopped working and devoted full time to preaching the gospel. I think this is what Paul is referring to in verse 9 in our passage here when he says, "When I was present with you and was in need, I was not a burden to anyone, for when the brethren came from Macedonia, they fully supplied my need." That was, I think, that first time when he went there. He was alone and he had no resources, so he worked as a laborer until Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia. And although Acts doesn't say so specifically, presumably Paul could stop working at that point because they brought some financial contributions from the Macedonians for Paul, so that they and Paul could devote themselves to the gospel. So that money came from Macedonia. The Corinthians didn't pay Paul anything. The Macedonians seem to have. And now we know that Paul never did accept any money from the Corinthians themselves. In Paul's earlier letter, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul explained why he doesn't take money from them, at least one reason why he doesn't take money from them. First, he made a strong argument that he has a perfect right to be paid. So it's not that he didn't take money because he doesn't think he has a right to take their money. He thinks it's entirely appropriate for the apostles to make a living from the people that they are serving. It's entirely appropriate for the people that they are teaching to supply them with what they need to live so that they can fulfill their ministry. He says, that's great. That's the way it should be. But then he goes on to say that when it comes to you guys, I don't do that. So starting in 9:11 of 1 Corinthians, he says, "If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we should reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things, that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share with the altar? So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. But I have used none of these things, and I am not writing these things that it may be done so in my case. For it would be better for me to die than have any man make my boast an empty one." So, we see several important things there. Paul believed that it was right and good for the churches to pay the apostles who came to minister to them. But Paul never took any money from the Corinthians. He said that he didn't take any money so that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. And what I understand him to mean there is that Paul, by not taking any money, is preventing anyone from saying, well, Paul's just in it for the money. He doesn't care about us. He's just doing it so that he can make some money off of us. If he doesn't take any money, then nobody can claim that he is taking advantage of them or just doing what he's doing for the sake of the money. And interestingly, Paul says that it is his boast that he does not take any money. He's going to use that language again in, as we see here in 2 Corinthians. Now, he doesn't mean that he's bragging about how great he is for not taking money, but it is something that he points to with satisfaction. This is a good thing I'm doing. I'm not taking any money from you. I don't want my boast, that is, I don't want the fact that I'm saying I don't take any money from the Corinthians, I don't want that to turn into an empty boast by actually taking money from you. I always want to be able to say that I am not relying on your money. Now, we know that other churches sent money to Paul as he was traveling around. He writes to the Philippians, commending them for sending him a sizable gift so that he can sustain himself in his difficult circumstances. So, why is it that he didn't take any money from the Corinthians while he was there? It may be that it was Paul's practice not to be paid directly, by the people he was ministering to. When I'm here, I don't want you paying me as if I'm an employee or something. That's possible, but it has always sounded like more than that to me. Paul came to recognize the shaky ground that he stood on with the Corinthians, and so it seems quite possible to me that he decided never ever to accept any money from them, because he thought that with this group, they're likely to accuse me of something, so I'm just not going to do it. The interesting thing, of course, is what we learn in 2 Corinthians, is that refusing to take any money from them did not protect Paul from criticism, because he is criticized for not taking money from them. So, what are you going to do? I mean, now, it's difficult to say exactly what the criticism was. I mean, why would that be a bad thing, that he wasn't taking money from them? Let me run some possibilities by you for the sorts of things that might be involved. First of all, it may be related to this charge that as a speaker, Paul was unskilled, that is, like a layman, an amateur, untrained. Because those who went around offering their services as speakers and teachers were paid to do so. The sophists would go out and they would demonstrate their superiority of speech. They would cut down the other speakers and say, that guy's out of it. You need to be following me. You need to be listening to me. You need to have me do the speaking that you need done, and you need to pay me for those services. Many years earlier, Socrates was criticized for not taking money for his teaching. There's a famous statement that Antiphon made to Socrates: if you set any value on your company, you would insist on getting the proper price for that too. It may be that you are a just man because you do not cheat people through avarice, but wise you cannot be since your knowledge is not worth anything. So you may be the sort of guy who's not avaricious and stealing people's money. Great, but it just shows that what you have to say isn't worth anything because nobody's paying for it. I remember a story that my dad told me. You all have probably heard stories like this yourself. You may have your own stories like this. But for a brief time, my dad was going to art shows selling his paintings. Just an amateur painter, but he was having fun going to shows and painting and having people look at them. But nobody was buying anything that he was selling. One of the other painters told him that the reason he wasn't selling anything is that he wasn't charging enough. If the paintings don't cost a significant amount, people will think they're not worth anything. So Dad started charging a lot more money, and then he started selling paintings. Okay, so I don't know if that's related to what's going on here, but maybe the charge is being made that Paul's wisdom must not be worth much because he's unwilling to charge for it. He's not a professional. Related to this may have been a prejudice against those who work with their hands. When Paul first came to the Corinthians, he is working as a tent maker, or whatever he was doing with leather. He is not a professional teacher, he is a laborer. So that may have been used against Paul by his opponents. That is proposed by some as what might be involved with the fact that Paul wasn't a paid teacher. Another possible criticism may have been that Paul was insulting the Corinthians. In that culture, if you had a financial patron, someone who was supporting you, then you took on a certain social obligation to that person. But it looks like Paul was not willing to be dependent and beholden to the Corinthians. Notice that Paul says, "Am I doing this because I don't love you? God knows I do." So perhaps the critics are saying that Paul's financial independence from them shows that he doesn't love them. He's keeping his distance. He doesn't want to be obligated to them. He doesn't want to be entangled in a financial relationship with them. And it might be all the more insulting because Paul accepted financial support from the Macedonians. As we saw before, the Macedonians were much poorer than the Corinthians. And yet Paul would take their money, and he wouldn't take the Corinthians' money. So this could look like Paul was essentially disrespecting the Corinthians by refusing to take their money. Another possible criticism is that Paul was being devious. We saw this when we looked at when he was talking about the Jerusalem collection. That is, he was collecting money from the various churches to send to help the poor in Jerusalem and Judea. So it's possible, as we look at the various things that are said in 2 Corinthians, it's far from certain, but it's possible, that part of the criticism might be that Paul only looks like he's not accepting money from them. But he is, in fact, unbeknownst to them, using the money from the Jerusalem collection to line his own pockets. We know from chapters 8 and 9 that Paul insisted that he was handling the collection of money for Jerusalem with integrity, and that there were other people involved from other churches, and they would be able to testify that the money was being handled with integrity. And if you're defending the integrity of the way you handle money, it's probably because somebody is saying that you're not handling the money with integrity. That's possible. Later in chapter 12, he's going to defend himself and his fellow workers from the charge of having taken advantage of the Corinthians. So it does sound possible that some of Paul's critics charge him with duplicity. He only refused to be paid directly so he would look like a good guy, but all the while he's skimming some off the top for himself. We don't know exactly what is involved with all this stuff. Maybe all of these factors enter into this somewhat. Paul doesn't charge for his services, so maybe they aren't worth anything. He's not a professional. He's just a laborer, after all. He makes tents. And it's insulting that he won't take our money. And anyway, I think he might be secretly taking some of that money out that was meant for Jerusalem. You put all of that together, and that becomes a significant charge against Paul's character, indicated by the fact that he's not accepting money from them. So as I say, it's hard to be definitive about that, but somewhere in the midst of that is probably the explanation for why his critics brought this up against him. They didn't say, well, you know, we have problems with Paul, but at least he's not taking our money. No, they're saying, here's why you shouldn't be listening to Paul. He's not taking our money. So somehow, that's bothering them. At any rate, this is the situation that Paul has to deal with. These are the kinds of charges being made against him. So he says, did I commit a sin in not charging you for the gospel? Is that what my opponents have convinced you of? Well, I'm not sorry that I didn't charge you, and I intend to keep on not charging you. This boasting of mine, he says, will not be stopped in the regions of Achaia, that is, where the Corinthians are. I will continue to be able to say, I will continue to be able to boast that I took no money from you, Corinthians. Notice how that echoes what he said in 1 Corinthians. I don't want my boast to be an empty one. I don't want to start taking money from you so that my boast, my pointing to the fact that I don't accept money from you, would become an empty boast. And he's basically saying the same thing here. I'm going to continue to boast in the fact that I don't take money from you, Corinthians. And then Paul gives the reason why he intends to continue offering the gospel for free in Corinth. And this becomes another reason. In 1 Corinthians, he talked about how he didn't want to hinder the gospel by taking money from them, presumably by looking as if he was in it for the money. Now he's giving a related reason. It's like that reason, but it's specifically related to this problem that he has opponents in Corinth who have come in, teachers who are coming in and setting themselves up in opposition to him. He says, and this is a tough sentence to follow here, we'll talk about it, but what I am doing, I will continue to do, that I may cut off opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the matter about which they are boasting. Okay, so let me paraphrase what I understand Paul to be saying here. He's saying, I'm going to continue to offer the gospel to you for free, and here's why. There are those among you who boast that they are what I am. That is, they make the same claim that I do. They are teachers who speak for Christ. And these are these ones who have come in and set themselves against Paul. So he's saying, I want to cut off the opportunity for them to make this boast. that they're like me. We all know that they are quite willing to take your money. Well, let's see how they look if while they are taking your money, I teach you for free. It is certainly going to be hard for them to claim to be my equal as servants of Christ. I think that's what he's getting at. He's basically saying, I'm going to continue not to take your money so that it becomes clear that my opponents here have a different agenda going on. Their claim to be what I am is going to look somewhat foolish. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it is not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their deeds. So, this seems to indicate that Paul's opponents have been claiming to have authority. It's a big deal, these ones who have come in. They're saying that they're something and that Paul isn't. He says they're disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. Now, they're obviously not claiming to be the apostles of Christ like Peter and John, but they are Jews who are perhaps claiming to speak with the authority of the Jerusalem community. Obviously, we don't exactly know what they claimed or what they taught. Paul doesn't talk much in 2 Corinthians about what they taught. What he talks about is how they have opposed him and are urging the Corinthians to reject him. And some of the Corinthians were listening to them. Paul uses the strongest possible language to describe them: false apostles, deceitful workers, servants of Satan, who, like Satan himself, disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end shall be according to their deeds. And it doesn't sound like that end is going to be good. So this is a big deal from Paul's perspective. They have made a big and false claim about themselves. So to listen to them is really going to lead you astray. This goes back to his image of these opponents are like the serpent in the garden leading Eve astray. Okay, so let's step back and look at the whole picture that Paul's describing here. He has been talking about why he is jealous and fearful. He is jealous that the Corinthians may be running off with other teachers, with Paul's opponents. He is fearful that his opponents are going to lead the Corinthians to their downfall. And he has responded to some of the personal criticisms made against Paul to remind the Corinthians that there is no reason for them to mistrust him. Okay, but now remember where Paul started in chapter 11 at the beginning. I wish that you would bear with me in a little foolishness. We haven't got to that yet. Paul is going to do something that could be called foolish, but we haven't seen what that is. He's been telling them why he is going to do this foolish thing. He has this jealousy for them, this fear they are being led astray by these false apostles. So that's what he's been getting at. Now he returns to this question of this foolish thing that he's going to do. And he starts to allude to that again. In 16, again I say, let no one think me foolish, but if you do, receive me even as foolish, that I also may boast a little. That which I am speaking, I am not speaking as the Lord would, but as in foolishness, in this confidence of boasting. Since many boast according to the flesh, I will boast also. For you, being so wise, bear with the foolish gladly. For you bear with anyone if he enslaves you, if he devours you, if he takes advantage of you, if he exalts himself, if he hits you in the face. To my shame, I must say that we have been weak by comparison. That was sarcasm. That was like... Paul's words are filled with so much sarcasm that they are like knives. You can almost feel them drawing blood. This is a really contemptuous way to talk to someone. In essence, he's saying, look, my opponents like to boast according to the flesh. Okay, you've been listening to their boasts according to the flesh. I'm going to join them. I'm going to do a little foolish boasting according to the flesh. Now, I don't want you to think of me as foolish, but I know that in a certain sense, what I am about to do is foolish. The Lord would not speak this way in this confidence of boasting that I'm about to go into. But hey, this is how my opponents talk. You've been listening to them, so I'm going to join them. I'm going to talk this way too. And then he gets super sarcastic. I know that you will have no problem bearing with me in my foolishness. When I speak in this foolish boasting way, I know you're not going to have any problem because look at how you have responded to them. Paul says, you, being so wise, bear with the foolish gladly. For you bear with anyone if he enslaves you, if he devours you, if he takes advantage of you, if he exalts himself, if he hits you in the face. I mean, Paul's basically looking at it and saying, these guys have come along and they're going to destroy you. I mean, this is the same sarcasm he used earlier, but now he's really, really tightening the screws. They could do anything to you, and you just step back and say, oh, it's okay. Yeah, you're interesting guys. Let's listen to him some more. So Paul's saying, I know you're not going to have any problem with my foolish boasting because look at how accepting and tolerant you are of them as they have come in and beaten you up, metaphorically speaking. Say, in comparison with them, I'm nothing. I haven't imposed on you. To my shame, I must say that we have been weak by comparison. I haven't nearly done anything to you like what they have done to you. I should have been working harder here. So Paul obviously is really letting them have it. I'm about to do some foolish boasting, just like my opponents. But hey, I know you won't have any problem with it because you certainly don't seem to have any problem with them. Okay, here we go. Finally, in verse 21b, we finally get to the actual process of this foolish boasting according to the flesh that Paul is now going to indulge himself in. But in whatever respect anyone else is bold, I speak in foolishness, I am just as bold myself. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I more so. In far more labors, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death, 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes, 3 times I was beaten with rods, 1 I was stoned, 3 I was shipwrecked, a night and a day I have spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship, through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. Apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern for all the churches. Who is weak without my being weak? Who is led into sin without my intense concern? Okay, so this is Paul's list of foolish boasting that he's indulging in because he's going to match his opponents. They're going to boast this way? Okay, I'll boast this way. The first set of boasts has to do with being Jewish. Are they Hebrews, Israelites, descendants of Abraham? So am I. Evidently, Paul's opponents were relying on their Jewishness as some sort of evidence of their authority. We don't know that these are Judaizers because Paul doesn't really deal much with their theology in 2 Corinthians. But remember what happened in what we see in the letter to the Galatians, when Paul describes what happens when some of the Jewish Judaizers from Jerusalem went to Antioch, where the first Gentile church was. They came, they clearly didn't approve of the fact that the Gentiles were eating with the Jews. Peter backed off and stopped eating with the Gentiles. But there was this sort of sense that there was some sort of authority that they had, that you didn't want to mess with them, because after all, they're from Jerusalem. They're part of the original stock here or something like that. So I can just imagine that the ones who have come into Corinth, a largely Gentile church, have made a big deal of the fact that they are Jewish and probably that they're coming from the Jerusalem church and expecting to be listened to as having a certain amount of authority because of that. Now, Paul doesn't believe that his Jewishness actually gives him any right to be heard. After all, Paul has sent Titus to them with a great deal of power and authority, and Titus is a Gentile. To boast in his Jewishness is what Paul would call a foolish boasting in the flesh. But if they're going to do it, okay. By doing this, Paul makes the boasting of his opponents look foolish. Hey, are they saying it's a big deal that they're Jewish? Okay, well, so am I. So that's that. There goes that one. They're saying don't listen to Paul. Well, if they ought to be listened to because they're Jewish, I guess that would say you ought to listen to me because I'm Jewish, which is, of course, not what Paul believes. But if that's the kind of argument they're going to make, then okay, I'll get in that ring with them. The next set of boasts concerns the hardships Paul has undergone as a servant of Christ. He says, are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I more so. Now, we can get something of a picture of what they must have been saying by this list that Paul gives. It seems that Paul's opponents were portraying themselves as servants of Christ in the sense that they have taken on the sacrifice of being a bondservant of Christ. There are hardships that come with taking on this role of representing Christ in the world, and they have taken on that role, and so they deserve respect for the sacrifice that they have made to make themselves teachers to the Corinthians. Well, you can see where Paul's going with this. Okay, if they're going to portray themselves as bondservants of Christ who have sacrifice themselves so that you might hear their message, Paul says, all right, well, are they servants of Christ? Let me talk to you about my life as a servant of Christ. Now, I think Paul hates this way of talking. Are we really going to compare sufferings here? He says, I speak as if insane. He says, there's something about doing this that is extremely distasteful. But if they're going to do this, if they're going to portray themselves as these noble, self-sacrificing servants of Christ, then, and they're going to dismiss me in the process, then, okay, let's compare jobs. Let's compare their service and mine. Now, I don't know about you, but if in your life you have come to have any sort of affection and gratitude toward Paul, as you have read his letters, this list has to be very affecting. I mean, he had a very, very hard life. He's talked throughout this letter about the difficulties that he has taken on for their behalf, but this is that list that people sort of read and go, oh my gosh, this was a really, really hard life. Remember that when, was it Ananias? Was that the name? He was sent to Paul. When Paul first had the Damascus Road experience, Ananias was sent to Paul, and Jesus told Ananias that he was going to show Paul all the things he must suffer for my sake. And this list shows that that was not an exaggeration. I mean, Paul had a very, very difficult life. So I want to remind you of a story from Acts. I'll just remind you of the story real quick. This is Paul goes to Jerusalem. He goes into the temple to show that he still respects his Jewish religious background. He gets accused of bringing a Gentile into the temple, and a huge crowd starts beating him up. The Roman soldiers come, and the commander allows Paul to speak to the people. Paul gives his testimony, and another riot starts. So the commander takes Paul and is going to scourge him to find out what he did wrong. He has him stretched out and tied up. He's going to beat him up. And then Paul says, you allowed to do this to a Roman citizen, are you? And he said, Roman citizen? Oops. So in the end, Paul doesn't end up getting beaten up. But the commander takes Paul to appear before the Sanhedrin, where things got so wild that it looked like Paul would be torn to pieces. So the Roman soldiers have to take him out of there quickly. At that point, 40 Jews make a solemn vow that they are going to kill Paul or die trying. So the commander sends Paul to Caesarea with 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spear carriers, so that nobody attacks him to kill him on the way. At Caesarea, Paul makes a defense before the governor, Felix. And Felix is sort of intrigued with Paul, so he gives him a little freedom, but he keeps him under detention for 2 years. Then Felix is replaced by another governor, and in order to save his life, Paul appeals to Caesar. He knows about the plot to kill him that is out there, and so he appeals to Caesar. And so Paul is sent to Rome. He goes on a hazardous sea journey and ends up being shipwrecked. When they land, he is bitten by a viper, but he just shakes it off and nothing happens to him. And so the people of the island decide that he's a god, and he does various miracles while he's there and so forth. Paul finally arrives at Rome and stays there under essentially house arrest for 2 years. So it seems to be that there are at least 4 years of Paul's life where he is under arrest, all because he was falsely charged with bringing a Gentile into the temple by those Jews who opposed his gospel. Now, why did I tell you this story? The interesting thing about that story is that it had not happened yet when Paul wrote 2 Corinthians. That list that I just gave with the shipwrecks and the beatings and all of that stuff, Paul wasn't talking about that because that hadn't happened yet. Paul says that he was shipwrecked 3 times, but that doesn't include the one shipwreck that we read about in Acts, which was when he was on his way to Rome, after he had written 2 Corinthians. Paul says that he was often in danger from his countrymen, but that doesn't include the riots in Jerusalem where he was beaten and nearly torn apart. Paul says he was beaten 3 times with rods, which is what the Gentile soldiers would have done, the Romans would have done. That didn't happen to him in Jerusalem when he told the commander that he was a Roman citizen, but obviously that protection didn't always work because he says 3 times he was beaten with rods. It was the practice of the Jews to take blasphemers into the synagogue and give them 39 lashes. What I hear is that the law had set the limit at 40 lashes, so they did what is called putting a hedge around the law. They gave you 39 lashes just in case they had miscounted, so that they wouldn't accidentally break the law by giving you 41 lashes. Paul had this done to him 5 times. Then Paul adds to the list the psychological sufferings of being a servant of Christ, the daily pressure of concern for all the churches. If someone is weak, it makes Paul weak. Now, what does he mean by that? I think it's not in the same sense. I think he means something like this. If Paul hears of someone who is weak in the faith, who is having trouble standing up under the pressures of life, or is following the wrong gospel or something, then Paul is weakened by that. He feels the burden of this thing that is happening. He has a lot of compassion for the people that he has taught. Frankly, a lot of them are a mess, and he feels the emotional weight of concern for their spiritual welfare. And you know, if there are people that you care about and you see them going the wrong way, that is a great burden. That is a difficult thing to take on. Well, Paul had this for every group that he went to and all the people that he talked to throughout the Mediterranean. He goes, he founds a church, and then he finds out, like what's happening in Corinth, that everybody's messed up and false teachers have come in and people are saying that they shouldn't listen to Paul and they're going to end up dying and going to hell because they're not listening to Paul and they don't think they should listen to Paul, and Paul is trying to convince them why they should listen to him without bragging about himself, because he says, I'm not a big deal, but I am an apostle, and if you don't listen to me, you're going to perish. I mean, this is a burden. This is like, it just never ends. He's always hearing these stories about all of the things that are going wrong. Okay, needless to say at this point, Paul's opponents don't compare very well in this comparison. They have not suffered what Paul has suffered physically to proclaim the gospel, and they don't share Paul's concern for the spiritual welfare of the flock. That concern adds greatly to Paul's suffering, since so many seem to be confused and drifting. Okay, so in this chapter, I see Paul is doing three things. First, he expresses his fears that the Corinthians are going to be seduced away from the faith by these opponents of Paul who have come into Corinth. Second, Paul defends himself against various charges made by his opponents. The charge that he's not a true apostle, the charge that he is an unimpressive amateur as a speaker and teacher, the charge that he is deeply suspect because he would not accept money from the Corinthians. He defends himself against these charges. He's saying to them, this is not a good reason not to listen to me. These don't amount to anything. And the third thing he's doing, he enters into a foolish boasting contest with his opponents. He does not do this because he thinks that such boasting in itself is worthwhile. Paul would never say, you Corinthians should listen to me because I am Jewish. Paul would never say, you Corinthians should listen to me because I've suffered a lot. But Paul shows how foolish the boasting of his opponents is. He's saying, hey, even by their own foolish standards, I still win. Let me back up a little bit on that. In a sense, there is substance to Paul's catalog of sufferings. I don't think in a different context that he would trot this list out. He doesn't go, I'm pretty sure, to new churches where or new places where he's preaching the gospel and say, you know, before I tell you about Christ, let me tell you about my sufferings. Oh man, I was shipwrecked and I did all this. That's not his message. And that's not what he thinks is the most convincing thing that he has to say. In this context, he's talking about this stuff precisely because of the kind of dismissal of him that is happening from his opponents. But there is substance to this list. It does amount to something. It doesn't prove that Paul is an apostle, certainly. There are certainly megalomaniacs in the world who are willing to take on great suffering and hardship just because they're convinced they're real important and the world needs to hear from them. That could be. Paul could be a guy like that. So his sufferings on behalf of the gospel don't prove that he ought to be listened to. But he has upped the ante on his opponents. His opponents are saying, you shouldn't listen to this guy. He's not really an apostle. We're the servants of Christ in this situation. Paul is at least saying, I'd just like you to look at the situation. Let's think about this objectively. Here's my life. This is what I have done. This is what I have gone through to bring this message to you. So you tell me, what do you think of that? What does that amount to? How do the claims of my opponents stack up when you think about their claim to be sacrificial servants of Christ, and then you look at my life? The only thing I want to say in conclusion, there's not a lot of theological points to make from this chapter or anything, but I'd just conclude by saying that I find this chapter very emotionally compelling. It has a kind of a grim humor in all of the sarcasm that he uses. Paul, for one thing, is being rejected for his style over his substance. This whole thing about the way he speaks and that he doesn't have the polish of the trained professional speaker or that sort of thing. That's an important issue. That seems to me to be a fundamental issue for that we have to wrestle with as well. And yet, he is confident that if the Corinthians are honest, they will see that he has the true wisdom of an apostle. He's really asking them to think about the substance of the knowledge that he has imparted to them versus how he stacks up against professional teachers. And then it's very compelling the way Paul shows us his heart in this chapter. His sufferings are almost unimaginable. I mean, I just can't imagine living a life like this. But he has done it all because of love. He loves the gospel, and he loves the Corinthians. Okay, so we have a few minutes for any comments or questions that you might have.
One thing that kind of comes out from what you're talking about the Corinthians is kind of the parallels we have today in particularly, lack of a better word, Hollywoodized, going back, clear back, I don't remember seeing these, but hearing about Marcus Welby, MD, doing his commercials on pain reliever, and people said, this is Marcus Welby, this right. must be good.
I am not a doctor, but I play one on TV.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And I kind of see Corinth as a culture that has this, and some of my thinking with the Judaizers is that they may have, like, okay, an enemy of mine and yours, we can work together against Paul. In other words, I think that there may have been Judaizers that said, oh, there's this culture that we can work with the people there against Paul. And
right, let me just say to that before you go any farther that, okay. yeah, that's quite possible. As you read 1st and 2nd Corinthians, like 1st Corinthians has the picture of there being factions in Corinth. And the clear implication there is that some of those factions are set against Paul. They're aligning themselves with someone like Apollos, precisely not because Apollos has tried to rouse them against Paul, but because they're saying, we don't want Paul. We like Apollos. We'll listen to him. So there seems to be, in the community, people who are less than thrilled with Paul. In this section, we have seems to be talking about explicit people who have come from the outside and are bringing a message that Paul doesn't like, and they are urging people to dismiss Paul. So it's quite likely, as you say, that there might be some kind of... it's hard to say which came first. Did the outsiders come in and build up the factions, or did the factions exist and then those outsiders who want to teach something different than what Paul taught are using that to take advantage of it and kind of... So we don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but you're right. It could be that way.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's so much important, the chronology, as the thinking that was going on. Two of my favorite presidential figures both had terrible voices, and one was even considered to be ugly. And the first one was Lincoln, and the second one was Theodore Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think it reflects on the culture that they were able to get over these things and hear that, yeah, these people had real substance that they were telling people. And I think that speaks to the values that a culture holds when they're able to accept the content over physical or other features.
Right.
And as I say, I think we have that type of thing in Corinth, that the Hollywoodizing, it's not what they say, it's how it's said.
Anything else?
Verse 4.
Yeah.
For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, when he says this, he's saying something like, these people aren't just telling you things about Jesus that are incorrect. They're so incorrect that they're talking about somebody that's not really Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that kind of discussion, but I've said it myself, actually, comparing people who had beliefs that I thought were a little incorrect versus Mormon or whatever.
Right.
Is there so much hyperbole in this that it's hard to... I have trouble understanding how far he's going with this.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know how to answer that question because I don't know what the issue is. I mean, we could go to Galatians and read what he has to say about this different gospel that the Judaizers preached, and we could try to figure out what is his problem with it from that situation. But I don't know whether that applies to this situation as well. All we can say is, I don't think that you use, when you say these people are like the serpent seducing Eve in the garden, or they are servants of Satan who, just like himself, who appears as an angel of light, are disguising themselves as servants of righteousness, we can't fairly call that hyperbole, I don't think. I mean, it's strong language, but I don't think we could back off and say, you know, I'm just saying they're a little irritating, aren't they? I mean, he really does seem to be suggesting that there's something about what they're doing that if you take it seriously, it will destroy you. But it doesn't, you know, there are all kinds of different ways that that could be. I mean, it might not be that there is specific content. I mean, there may be, but the seduction may be that worldliness that would say, yeah, Paul is kind of unimpressive, isn't he? Yeah, Paul is always talking about the cross and all of this stuff, and I can look around my culture, and there are all kinds of interesting people who have all sorts of fascinating things to say in a powerful and persuasive way. So it's just kind of cutting away at the roots of creating a sense of dissatisfaction with the gospel that Paul is preaching. That would be enough to say to be like the serpent in the garden. Or it could have real specific theological content. Paul's saying this, and we're saying, no, it's like this instead. I wonder about that because Paul does so little talking in this long letter about anything that sounds like a theological disagreement with his opponents. It's all the fact that they would call Paul and his gospel into question. That in and of itself is a profoundly serious thing to do. So I would kind of lean in that direction, but it's hard to say. Like I said, I don't know if you were here when I answered another question, it was last week or the week before, but it is interesting that one of their claims is that they're Jewish, the opponents, that that's significant that they are Jewish. It is interesting that in the one section in this letter where there's some, well, I won't say one section, but one section in the letter where there's some theologically significant stuff going on, it's that part where Paul is talking about comparing his ministry of the new covenant with the old covenant ministry of Moses. And one could speculate that he puts it in those terms at that spot because there is some sort of elevation of the law going on in Corinth, and maybe it's from something like the Judaizers or something. But it's hard to say. But yeah, that's a good question. We don't know, but I would go back to what I said. I think something that could seduce me away from the truth can be a different truth, or it can be an undercutting of what I'm being asked to have confidence in the gospel, so that I just become apathetic, indifferent to it, and looking for something more interesting or something. It doesn't have to have a specific content so much as an appeal to my flesh to stop listening to this prickly, difficult gospel message. Okay, go and be cool.